And you see, he said, he who loves his life will lose it. The hardest thing I have to get across to people today is that this is not supposed to be a nice life. If they go for the nice life, they're in trouble. Because I cannot guarantee it to anybody. I had to say that to someone today. Your big problem, I said, is that you are more concerned to have a happy marriage than you are to follow Christ. And you're never going to have it. Until you get over trying to have a nice life for yourself, you're going to just have to struggle with what you've got. I can only guarantee peace, and I will guarantee it, 100%, money back, absolutely. I will guarantee peace to you in your heart as soon as you quit trying to be happy. And a lot of the marriage manuals that are put out today are responsible for some of this, because they keep telling people, you know, these are the things to do so you people can be happy in your home. And so they try all these little goodies, and it still doesn't work. Because the big thing is that they should be concerned about the Lord and about other people's work, you see. I told this one fellow, you see, I said, if I was worried about a happy home, I wouldn't be able to sit here and talk to you. I'd be spending all my time trying to make a happy home. So give it up. Give up the dream. Because it's pretty sketchy anyway. Even if you get the dream, you find out it was a nightmare. You know, if you get everything you think you ought to have, everything, it turns sour. I was thinking of that just this evening. I saw a fellow pull out of the parking place, and he had this very fancy chariot. It was an Oldsmobile Catalina, red with a white padded top, and all the goodies. It just fairly reflected a guy whose whole attention was on that kind of stuff. See, you know, I don't mean a person shouldn't have a new car. A lot of people buy a new car, and you need it. You need a new car, and you may need a nice car. But just the way that thing was set up, you could see where the guy's mind was. But it just reflected to me this thing that people just pouring money into things that they think are going to make them happy, but it don't make them happy. You see. But if you forget about it, it'll be different. Now, I'm going to talk to a fellow in a couple of days who has been for the last number of years fighting God. He's been mad at God because God hasn't given him what he wanted, and he's had a tough time, tough luck, and he's had trouble getting work, and he wouldn't talk to anybody like myself. The chance was offered to him a number of times, but he prefers to write bitter letters about how God let him down and everything else. So now, he's down so far that he finally agreed to talk to me. And usually I'm the last resort. After everybody's talked to everybody else they can think of and tried everything else, then they finally come around to me. Because they already know what I'm going to say. Say, well, he's desperate enough to talk to me. So you know what I'm going to have to tell him? See, now he's out of work. He desperately needs work. He's down to his last couple of bucks or whatever. And what I'm going to have to tell him is, I don't do so well at getting work for people. I'm going to tell him some of the last ones I talked to, I've been out of work for about a year now. So I can't help. And I said, but the best, I will tell him that the only thing I can say to him is that it'd be better for him to get hold of God and lie down beside the street and die if he has to than to get himself all upset about his employment and blaming God for not having employment. I happen to feel that the Lord has ways of getting through to a guy, and he's not going to let him starve to death, but I'm not going to guarantee it. I cannot guarantee that he won't starve to death, but if he's going to starve to death, he at least better make peace with his Maker. Now, that's not a very nice way to talk to people, but it's true. There's a lot of people starving in this world. I've gone without a few meals myself in the past. I know what it is to be broke, not have a job, and so I'm not unsympathetic with them. But I know that as long as their chief concern is themselves, that they're not going to have peace. But when they're ready to put it in the Lord's hand and say, all right, Lord, if I perish, I perish. My life is in your hands. Then they're likely to have peace. So this is the lesson Jesus was giving to these Greeks. The Greeks were lovers of life. They really loved life. Over in Greece, everything was for living. Everything had to be beautiful and geometrical and harmonized and everything else. Back in the, you know, there was a period they called the Golden Age of Greece. That was back in, well, roughly we call it from 500 to 400 BC, but precisely and specifically, it really lasted from about 461 to 431, about 30 years in the age of Pericles was really the high point of Greek culture. But everything went into this world, this life, cultivation of their habits, culture, drama and art, sculpture, literature. Everything had to be exquisite. Anything that wasn't beautiful, they didn't want it around, you see. So they loved life. They built these great, beautiful temples like the Parthenon in Athens. Up on the hill, they built this whole, the Parthenon. They had the various buildings within that Parthenon. And it was a magnificent thing. Of course, today you go over to Greece, everything is in ruins, rubble. Parthenon, in all of its excellence, is just a pile of stones. But Jesus tried to tell these Greeks that there's nothing in this world for them. If you want to save your life, he says, if you work so hard to have a happy life here, it's a sure bet you're going to wind up empty. You're not going to have it. So the only thing I can say to anybody in the way of having peace is that they will have peace as soon as they quit trying to be happy. As a matter of fact, we've been talking about this school. I said I was going to lay some things on the people as far as the school is concerned. But you're going to have to sacrifice one of two things, either yourself or your children. We've got two ways to go. We either give our kids to somebody else to take care of, like a public school, or some of the questionable Christian schools around. You can give it to them to take care of, or take care of them yourself. Now, in our situation, we have a cooperative deal where the parents come together and all cooperate to train their children. But that takes sacrifice. They have to sacrifice themselves. People run around with all their happy romantic notions, having babies, and forget that maybe they got to take care of the baby after they bring it into the world. The baby didn't ask to come into the world. They brought that child in the world. They were playing games or whatever they were doing. They brought a child into the world. Very few people have children because they have a great passion to have children so they can take care of these sweet little darlings. All the rest of their life, they can't wait to have babies. That's not why most people have babies. They have babies because they want to love. Right? That's pretty straight, but it's true. The baby is a necessary byproduct of their enjoyment. All right, then the baby comes. Now they have all kinds of fits because they're supposed to take care of it. But I have to say to people, you're never going to get over taking care of your children until you go to the grave. Maybe even in heaven you're going to have to do it.
Yeah, I look at that way to a certain extent, David. Mm-hmm.
Sure, they ought to grow up. They ought to grow.
They don't ask to be brought into this world. Mm-hmm. It's up to them how they leave this world.
Sure it is.
Can't help that.
That's right, Gene. They have to make up their own mind whether they want to follow Christ or not. That's their thing. But we've got to give them every chance we can to help them, see, that's all. But the main thing I want to say is that you're never really rid of the responsibility, even if they're on their own, in quotes. They love to get out on your own. But I made a bargain with my kids, I made a commitment to them, rather, that no matter what kind of trouble they were in, they were always welcome to come back to my house. And I meant it, and I have shown it. They can always come put their feet under my table if they need help. Well, the Lord does that with us too, but the point I'm making is this. There is a sacrifice involved in our lives. Now, though, if we quit fighting it and join it, we may be at peace. If we keep longing for that day when we'll be through with responsibilities, we're going to be always disappointed. You're never through with responsibilities to somebody. So why not just join the crowd? Not the crowd. The crowd doesn't go this route. But join the Lord's people. Join the Lord, let me say, and see life as primarily a responsibility thing, and then you'll be at peace. It's like the person who takes care of their finances, you see. Some people are always in hot water regarding their finances, because they're always living right out on the edge. And they load themselves up with debts and everything else, and it's always a headache. And when the check comes in, it should be a joyful occasion, but it isn't, because it's always a little bit short. And those people are always feeling bad. But compare that to the person who's managed their finances well, and they've had to do without a few things. They didn't get that nice red chariot with a white padded top. They still stayed with their little Volkswagen or whatever they had. And they had to drive the old clunker. But when bill-paying time comes, it's so nice to write a check out and know that it's going to be covered in the bank. And know that when you get through, you're going to have enough pennies left over to buy yourself a bottle of pop, at least. Not much more. But you see, responsibility is the key to peace of mind. You can be at peace no matter what anybody else around you is doing. They can flop around, you know, people. You can't depend on what somebody else is going to do. If you're worried about what your brother, or sister, your wife, your husband is going to do, you're going to be in trouble. You have to do what you have to do, and let them do what they have to do. And if you tie your peace of mind to their roller coaster, you're in for a wild ride. So just plug along, go out every day and say, all right, Lord, here I am. Help me to be what I ought to be. I counsel with people all the time who are so anxious and so uptight about what somebody else is that they're miserable. If they just quit worrying about what the other person is and be concerned about what they are and let the other person flop around all they want to, they're going to be at peace. Now, that's what it means to lose your life for Christ's sake. It means that you quit putting any value on the nice life thing. We've gotten into the habit which was sort of promoted, I think, by a certain previous era of the hippie era, which is pretty well over now. The expression, have a nice day, started there. And the only way you can really have a nice day is if you're irresponsible. I mean, if you don't care about anybody else. How in the world can you have a nice day if you've got friends that are in trouble, you know? If you've got, I mean, like in the day that when this thing was popping, there were a lot of people over there in Vietnam and great suffering and distress. There are a lot of people in the world that are suffering. And to ignore this and just say, well, have a nice day, when a great number of people in the world cannot have a nice day, there's no way they can have a nice day. But having a nice day is not where it's at. If you try to have a nice day, you're going to be disappointed. Try to have a day that is satisfactory. You try to have a day that is responsible. You have a day where you follow Christ and where you learn and you grow. Growing is where it's all about, what it's all about. If I have some experiences, and I have a few that are difficult, in fact, it's usually pretty well. Everything's in turbulence most of the time because I've got so many different things that I'm with, and all of them involve people, and wherever you're involved with people, you've got turbulence. There's no way you're going to avoid it. So in my business, my life, I never expect anything but turbulence. Everything is always, you know, fouled up. But I am at peace because I have put my time in the Lord's hands, my life in His hands. And I just go around and tend to things as I have to and let the people flop around. But the point is that when things hit that are hard I grow. You learn things. And you feel good about it because you know that something's happening. If everything is plowed up, you know something's happening. You can put a thick veneer on and make everything nice and lovely, sweet, but nothing's going on. It's just stagnant. Any stagnant pond can be still, you know. But when you get a lake where the fish are jumping and water's breaking all the time, you know there's life in it. Jesus was giving a tremendous principle. It's awfully hard to get to, though, because in America, you know, we've always assumed that we had a right to a nice life. And we felt we have a right to individual freedom. And that's a balloon that somebody should explode when a person is young. Because there is no such thing as absolute freedom. Unless you're living on a desert island somewhere by yourself, then you got absolute freedom. But it's a myth. You only have freedom in relation to others. You have only a relative freedom. You are free to do something, but you're not free to do anything you want. And it's this pursuit of absolute freedom that has gotten a lot of people into such a jam. I like to say to people, you have destructive liberties and constructive liberties. The destructive liberty, which no one can take away from you, is the right to destroy yourself. You can go out and blow up a storm with all the pot in town and move out in that line, or you can soak up the sauce and destroy your liver. You know, a lot of things you can do that nobody can stop you in a way from destroying yourself. You can go jump off a bridge if you want to. The constructive liberty is the liberty, the freedom to grow. And that nobody can take away from you, because if every experience you have is accepted by you as a growth experience, you're going to grow and nobody can stop you. The more they jump on you, the more you grow. The more they fight you, the stronger you get. That's a very important thing. The moment you make up your mind to go for growth, you are catapulted into the great, broad, limitless reaches of the freedom to grow. But if you go down the other right route, the right to make mistakes, the freedom to destroy yourself, if you make up your mind that you're going to have fun at any price, if you make up your mind you're going to grow at any cost, you have absolute freedom to grow. So those are two choices that you have to make. And you are beginning to live the moment you link up with Christ in the glorious experience of growing. A great experience of sacrifice. Of giving up your right to yourself. You don't worry about your rights anymore, and that's a great feeling. Because then people can do whatever they want to, and it's not going to bother you that much. So Jesus tried to knock a little sense into the head of these Greeks on that score, but it was pretty hard going. In fact, he finally had to hit them with a bolt of lightning here. Yes, go ahead.
Maybe it's just academic, but when he attacked the Pharisees had the Old Testament scriptures.
Yes.
Their approach to them was wrong. They were trying to do everything within themselves. But did the Greeks have anything to fall back? In other words, what was their relationship or access to God over the hundreds of years that they were going through this, seeking out all, you know, just trying to please themselves and everything worldly? Was there any witness of any kind?
All right, the main question you're asking is, was there any way at which the Greeks had access to the knowledge of God, of the true God? Primarily, the Greeks were, in their religious views, followed certain mythology, but you have to ask, where did the Greeks come from originally? And the answer is that there were part of them that migrated from the Middle East, where they would have had access to the knowledge of God, and part of them migrated down from the north, and that happened about 1500 BC. The shift of culture was from the Middle East, Mesopotamian Valley, over to Crete. From Crete up into the Greek peninsula, the Balkan area, the Peloponnesus, actually, we say. So that was part of the population of Greece, and that happened, as I say, about 1500. Then another population came down from the Baltic Sea area, but they got up the Baltic Sea. The migration was from the Indus River north up to the Baltic Sea. Now, in 1000 B.C., you had the Trojan War on the peninsula, Asia Minor Peninsula, up in the area just about where Constantinople is now. So I would say that there were enough contacts from a culture that began with the Middle East, with the they would have had some access to the truth, but it was not a broad access. Still, a lot of Greeks were God-fearers. That is, they were following the Jewish religion. There was evidently enough knowledge of God that they did not have to be in ignorance. Everywhere, the evidences are that God responded to simple search for himself in any culture. I could give you some number of stories along this line, but basically every culture in the world, every ethnic group, has had a form of worship. If you study anthropology and you would study all the cultures of the world, you'd find that every one of them has some form of worship. And missionaries say that when they go among these primitive people, the immoralities that they find that we're inclined to pass off and say that these are ignorant people who don't know better, the missionaries tell me that they do know better. That is to say that they are violating conscience when they do a lot of these things. They know better. There's a built-in sense of wrongdoing that is there. Usually in these cultures, in addition to whatever cultural religious rituals they've acquired, there is some focus in a spirit being, just like the Indians of America, North American Indian. We're always worshiping the Great Spirit. Now, what God is going to do with these people is up to him, but I think there are a lot of honest souls that were looking to the best that they knew that are going to be given grace by God in there. So I think all over the world there's enough built-in sensitivities on the part of man. In fact, John 1 says that the light, that the Logos lighted every man while he was coming into the world. Every person, that is. Women, too. Yeah, 1:18 and 19. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness by those who hold down the truth in all unrighteousness by those who hold down the truth in ungodliness. For that which may be known of God is clearly seen, being understood by the ones that are made, so that they are without excuse. Only God knows the level of responsibility of an individual heart. And there are a lot of people that hide behind ignorance that have no right to do that. That if they really would be open to the idea of God, that he would surely show them. In fact, one story I could tell you from out of China, Chinese missionary that I knew personally told me this story personally. It was a first-person experience, so I was not just getting it second-hand, but they came across a person in one of the villages in China that had been an idol maker. And while he was working on an idol one day, he began to think that it was kind of silly for him to make this thing and then worship it. So he said he really ought to worship what made him. So he began to pray to that which made me. That was the term he used. And he started praying to that which made me. And pretty soon a missionary came into the village and showed him the truth, and he became a Christian. But I believe that there is enough within the heart of every man for a response to God if they're open. on whatever level they respond to him, and whatever God accepts, that's up to him. But one thing is certain, everybody in the world who is accepted by God is accepted on the basis of the death and resurrection of Christ, the sacrifice of Christ. They may not even fully know or appreciate what that sacrifice was all about, but God's ability to be gracious to everybody in the world is based upon the sacrifice that Christ has made. So we have to just be very open about this, and we can't narrow things down too much. So I would say that there was some basis of appeal. In fact, the fact that these Greeks had sought out the Jewish Passover feast indicated that they had some knowledge. The Jews did spread the religion all around that part of the world. It spread from one to another. So these Greeks would not have been here if they had not had some kind of understanding of the Jewish religion, which at that time was the only real identity with God. The Christian religion was not developed at that point. And a person who was a Jew, or a God-fearer, as some of the Greeks called themselves, was accepted of God. But now Jesus is coming to these Greeks on a different level, because now Jesus is going about preaching eternal life on a different basis, on the basis of faith in himself and not on the basis of religious rules. The Pharisees had taken the plain truths of the Old Testament and perverted them by their own traditions. This was the Jesus' quarrel with the Pharisees was not over the Ten Commandments. His quarrel with them was over their expansion of the commandments into all of these little traditional things through which they lost sight of faith in God and became focused on their good works, which were not really part of the law of God, but part of their own little deal. And the reason they had so many of these traditions about doing these things was not because they wanted more to please God, but they wanted to spell it out so they wouldn't have to do more than was necessary to really follow God. And in other words, if the Bible says observe the Sabbath, they wanted to spell it out. Well, be that as it may, Jesus was confronting a different breed of cat with the Greeks, who were lovers of life and who had to come to grips with his teaching that he who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world shall keep it. Now, by hating, we understand from many passages that he just means to reject it. That is, to not put your weight on it. Just as he says to hate your father and mother, he that hateth not his father and mother is not worthy of me. Well, he didn't mean they had to emotionally hate them. He just meant that they had to be willing to follow him at the expense of having to reject their parents if they did not go along with it. Then Jesus said, if any man wants to minister to me, let him follow me, and where I am, there also shall my servant or minister be. By minister, he just means, it's not servant in the sense of slave, but servant in the sense of ministering to him in his needs, or in following him. Now he says, then Jesus goes on to say, now is my soul troubled. In turbulence, that's the Greek word there, it means turbulence. It's a word applied to a storm at sea, to the waves. Now is my soul in turbulence, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause I came to this hour. And that goes along with the idea that he gives us in the 18th of John, which we'll come to later, the cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? And that brings us back full circle to the point I started with. If we quit worrying about having a nice life and just identify with Christ and accept what he gives us, we'll be at peace. But most people are just never satisfied. And they're always looking to everybody else to make them happy. They think they're not happy because so-and-so does this and so-and-so does that and this person does this to me. And they never will be happy. If they just say, well, who cares, you know. just take it as it comes. When they have that attitude and they quit fighting for their own rights and fighting for their own self and their own happiness, then they have a fighting chance of being at peace. And I can guarantee that to you. I can guarantee immediate peace in your heart if you're willing to accept turbulence. That means if you're willing to accept the fact that where there is growth and progress, there is going to be disruption. The life is not going to be smooth if you want to grow. If you're growing, you're going to be in turbulence. So I told the people down there today, the two words that I leave with you that characterize our life on this earth, or should, turbulence and tolerance. You're going through turbulence. Your life is disrupted in many different ways. Relating to any people will disrupt your life. But we have to be tolerant of people because they're going through their turbulence too. We're all trying to survive. We're all functioning the way we have to function. If we're slow learners, then we're slow learners. If we're not doing everything everybody thinks we ought to be doing, maybe it's because we still have some growing to do. But we have to be tolerant of one another. We got enough trouble straightening our own life out without thinking about somebody else's. Somebody was telling me today in some counseling session that their situation at home was very bad, and there was just a lot of friction and trouble. I had to say to them that there's no way that they could come to peace if they're going to wait for the other person to straighten out. The other person is making their life miserable. The reason is that they're expecting too much from the other person. They're expecting their happiness from them. It's not going to happen. They got to give up the idea that they're going to have happiness from that person and just follow Christ. Otherwise, they'll make themselves miserable. Their bitterness creeps in, resentment. And I said to this person said, well, this one that they were talking about taught Sunday school, has been teaching Sunday school for 20 years or so, or whatever. And I said, it doesn't make any difference what they're doing for work for the Lord if their attitude is bitter and resentful. The work they're doing doesn't amount to a hill of beans. It's nothing. That's the message Jesus tried to get across to the Pharisees. It's the heart that counts. The Lord does not accept bitterness and resentment. He speaks very strongly about that, not to let a root of bitterness spring up. You may be the rightest person in the world, but if you're bitter about it or resentful, you're nothing. In God's eyes, you're zero. You may follow every rule to a T and be the greatest person on earth, but if you're bitter and resentful, God is not interested in that. Well, we're going to stop here. Thank you, Father, for this moment together. These words sometimes are hard, and yet we know so well that while we cannot be responsible for what somebody else does, we can be responsible for ourselves. And if we give up the right to being happy and the right to a nice life, we can be at peace, because then we don't expect anything. We just trust God to bring things out the way He wants them. Help us to love others. Help us to be open to others and not to be resentful or bitter, but to let the Spirit of Christ flow through us. In His name we pray. Amen.